listen to the show in HD at 100.3 HD2 FM.
This is Chicago's home for sports, ESPN Chicago.
Good morning. Happy Sunday to you. It is the first Sunday in May 2023, fresh off the first Saturday in May, which, of course, is Kentucky Derby Day. I know that one. I never forget about that because I actually got married on Kentucky Derby Day, May 3rd, 2008. Nevertheless, though,
wow. We react,
yeah. Wow. It wasn't done intentionally, and I did get a lot of pushback from some guests who were a little bit upset. One, Harry Tynowitz, actually was in attendance and very mad at me because the...
Harry's a horse family.
He absolutely is. The reception was going on in the midst.
Crypto Clearance was the signature horse for the Tynowitz family, I believe, right?
I'll have to take your word on it. But
did you have mint juleps at the open bar?
You know, we did not. That was a miss by us for sure.
No, have you ever had one?
Oh, I have. I've had two. And I don't think I'm going back, Bri.
Why did you have the second one?
I'm one of those people who I'm like, you know what? Maybe the first one I got, whatever it happens to be, maybe it wasn't a fair representation. So let's go back and make sure that it wasn't the actual whatever it happened to be, like that version. Let's give it a second chance. And, you know, I don't even think I finished the second one.
No. And, you know, yesterday on the whatever 8-hour broadcast, which I enjoy, you know, they show the bartender making the drink that no one likes. I'm you know, always I like pretty much try anything once when it comes to stuff like that, but I don't think I finished the one I started.
Yes, yeah.
And what's the old saying about martinis? One's enough, two's never enough, something like that. it's loudmouth soup is what it
sure,
is.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, I having been down to the Derby and I think Kentucky Oaks, and Edzo made a comment yesterday that early on, the crowd was well liquored up because that's what they do down there.
Yeah, and, I think that's generally the crowd at the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, the first time I went to the Derby, I was just out of college. We were in the infield. I heard horses. I don't believe I saw a horse. I saw a lot of other things in the infield, which I guess is, you know, people flashing people, things of that nature. But I always vowed that I'd go back at some point when I actually had some money in my pocket and sit in the stands and do it the right way. But anyway, the mint julep I've never got, but you Derby Day. Well, you know.
It wasn't intentional. It was one of those things where my wife and I were looking at the calendar when we picked up. You know, we're like, all right, this looks like a perfect spot. May 3rd, 2008. Let's do it. And so that's we just slotted it in and didn't even think twice about it until obviously as it was approaching, someone pointed out to me very quickly. It might have been Harry. Hey man, you know your wedding's in the middle of the Kentucky Derby. I was like, you know what? I was planning a lot of stuff. That was something that eluded me.
The event space was only available that day. The one we absolutely had to have. I don't know. It's like some people get married on Memorial Day weekend. I mean, there's certain weekends where, you know, people have things going on and now you want to be part of the celebration, but it's like, really? You had to do it the day after Thanksgiving? I mean, you know, people want to go shop.
Yes. No, exactly. Yeah. But I digress. Big Brown, by the way, won the Derby that day that I was married. Yeah. So, but I digress. We'll talk a little bit about the Derby because it did happen yesterday. I do think it's amusing to me. The Derby is something that we saw the 149th edition go off yesterday. But I don't think they drew it up this way. But it is tailor-made for social media and Twitter clips because you can watch the fastest 2 minutes right on your phone and then move right along. You don't have to consume that 8-9 hours of pregame show if you don't want to, Bri.
But I did because I'm kind of like Harry that way. I didn't have any connections. I'm still looking for that Derby horse. I got a horse at Gulfstream today. I'm not touting it by a stretch of imagination, but you know, only 6 horses in the field. So hopefully we find a way. My horse is not in the same class as your Derby horses.
Well, we can dream one day. Yeah. One day, yep. Bri. Keep at it. Again, he's Brian Hanley. I'm Jeff Meller. We're here with you till 11 o'clock. We will talk a little bit about yesterday's Derby later in the show. But before the Derby went off, how about a nice little day of baseball at Wrigley Field? The Cubs win courtesy of Nick Madrigal's go-ahead 2-RBI single.
Here's Madrigal. Base hit into right field. Bellinger in. Here's Velasquez to the plate. He's in. Madrigal to second and the Cubs lead. Nick Madrigal comes through.
You like the matchup there of Nick Madrigal. He likes to take the ball the other way. Great jump by Velasquez at second. Sliding in there with a go-ahead run.
Nick Madrigal coming up big, highlight there courtesy of Marquee Sports Network, coming up big against the Miami Marlins' best reliever in A.J. Puck. Now, they were using him in the eighth inning because he's essentially their closer, but that's kind of the modern baseball that we live in where you will sometimes go to your best reliever in the highest leverage position. The Marlins did that with A.J. Puck, but the Cubs were able to go ahead and get the job done. And it wasn't just Nick Madrigal who had a big moment. Oh, no, 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 no. Miguel Amaya came in and pinch hit and had himself one heck of a first major league hit.
Puck fires. Up the middle. Edwards charges under his glove and in to score is Madrigal. And that should be his first big league hit. Hugs!
Mom and dad are loving it.
It's a hit.
I tell you what, Miguel Amaya has come up already and he's hit some balls on the screws. He's lined out a few times. He went deep to center field. We mentioned it earlier. It's not always how hard you hit it. It's where you hit it. His first major league hit.
Dempster breaks it down there on Marquee. And then Jordan Bastian tweeted out shortly thereafter. How about to Dempster's point about Miguel Amaya absolutely just crushing the ball. No luck. Some of his first five contacts registered 100.2 miles per hour off the bat, 104.3 miles per hour, 102.1 miles per hour, 102.5 miles per hour, 103.9 miles per hour. Again, that's exit velocity for Miguel Amaya. Five of the first balls that he put in play, all of those went for outs. Then, Bri, he hits the dinker up the middle, 67.4 miles per hour, and sure enough, that goes for his first major league hit. Pretty cool moment there for the Cubs and Miguel Amaya yesterday at Wrigley Field.
Well, it's a line drive in the box score.
Absolutely.
And you talk about a feel-good story. And unfortunately for the Southsiders, there aren't a lot of them, and there aren't a lot of fans in the stands, and the team hasn't given them any reason to head to the rate.
Don't bring us down so early, Bri.
Well,
you're right.
Brian McCray told Sully, Paul Sullivan, some things that I found interesting. But, yeah, apparently the Cardinals are would love to have Miguel Amaya catching their pitching staff because it's Wilson Contreras' fault. But, yeah, that was a cool moment. His parents are there waving the Panama flag, crying, just tears of joy. And then there's Miguel in the postgame. And his parents are 5 feet from him, standing along the wall while he's being interviewed on Marquee, and he gets caught up in the moment.
Absolutely. This is courtesy of Marquee Sports Network, the postgame with Miguel Amaya, and you'll listen to it. The whole interview, the whole exchange definitely makes you, it tugs at the heartstrings if you have any soul. Even if you're not a Cubs fan like me, it was pretty cool to see Miguel Amaya really revel in this moment.
Go, Cubs, go. Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are going now into the...
I had to give you that moment. How awesome is this?
It is amazing. It is insane, you know, living the dream here, having these amazing fans here in Chicago at Wrigley Field. This is electric.
You get your first major league hit. What's going through your mind standing on first base?
Well, you know, sometimes you hit it hard, nothing happened. I got that knock in there, little jam, but finally I got my first one. I helped the team get another run. We won the game, so this is amazing. I'm just living the dream, you know, going day by day, and whatever they need me, I'm here to help them.
You've been hitting the ball really hard, have not had a ton of results to show for it. How did you stay consistent with the process, knowing that eventually one would get through?
Well, you know, you just got to be ready for it. You just got to be ready for it, for that moment. Is try to be the whole game focused on myself, watching every single play in the game, you know, like staying in the game. No matter what, if I'm on the bench, I'm just going to be there whenever they need me.
What will you do with your hit ball?
Sorry?
What will you do with the ball from your first hit?
Well, I don't have it yet, but they probably save it for me. I'm going to give it to my parents. That's a gift for them. You know, like, they've been with me 24-7 through everything, and this is all for them and for my family.
Speaking of your parents, they're right here. What's going to be the first thing you say to them?
Well, hug them, kiss them, probably cry with them. You know, we're so excited. They're dreaming the limb, too, so... we're here. We're going to keep enjoying. We're going to have so much fun. And, you know, let's go, Cubs.
There's Miguel Amaya after his first hit. As you said, Bri, in the box score, it's going to go down as a line drive frozen rope for his first career hit. And to hear him, though, bask in the glory at the end of the game.
Go, Cubs, go. Go, Cubs, go. Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are going now into the...
Pretty cool moment yesterday at Wrigley Field.
He sounds like me singing after Three Mint Juleps.
Yeah, see? Yeah. Well, how would you know? You wouldn't know how you sound after Three Mint Juleps there, Bri.
I'm guessing. I can name that tune and, ooh, off note, off key. But, you know, the Cubs pitching staff is doing, just going quietly going about its business without Kyle Hendricks. Leading the league in ERA going into yesterday's game with a 3.25 ERA. And I said a few weeks ago to you, and I said it last summer too, I would take the Cubs starting rotation over the White Sox starting rotation. And, you know, maybe that's not, you know, such a bold statement, but Justin Steele, mm-hmm. I mean, good Lord, 14 consecutive starts where he's allowed two or fewer earned runs. I mean, this guy and Kyle Hendricks, who's hopefully going to be back in a week or two, you know, said he dreams of having Justin Steele stuff. But, you know, that on Kyle Hendricks' best days, he's tickling the old 89, 90 sure. mile per hour, you know, breaking them, barely getting a 90. But that's OK. But boy, they just even in the 1-6 road trip, what they have 5-1 run losses.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't the pitching. The pitching gives them a chance pretty much every day. Now, Wesneski has been better since he's got roughed up a little bit, but he goes today. So this division, I mean, this division is crazy. You asked me last week, what, you don't believe in the Pirates? And another week's gone by, and the Pirates are still sitting atop the division.
Yeah, it definitely, when you look at the way the NL Central standings align right now, you would have certainly thought that it would have been, you know, top and bottom reversed when the season started. But the Pittsburgh Pirates are atop the division, and the St. Louis Cardinals don't know what's going wrong. Oh. You mentioned it, and this is something that I do want to talk about a little bit, because the Cardinals come to town tomorrow after the Marlins leave, and Wilson Contreras returns, and it doesn't seem like he will be returning as the St. Louis Cardinals starting catcher, as yesterday they announced that Wilson Contreras will be moving to a designated hitter outfield role going forward, which I think for any Cubs fan who was disappointed, Bri, in the fact that they did not sign him to a long-term deal, you know, this just goes to show why the Cubs were so reluctant to go ahead and sign Wilson Contreras to a long-term deal. They always knew his bat, and this, the Cardinals probably aren't going to completely regret the $87.5 million contract that they gave him, but I think a large part of his value was always thought, okay, you have an elite hitting catcher here, and that's part of what you're paying for. Now, the bat still plays in the outfield. He's still a productive, you know, left fielder if you're going to play him out there, or indefinitely as a DH he can get by, but that's a lot of money in 2023 to give a corner outfielder, unless his bat's going to play up because he's no longer, you know, worn down by catching. Because, you know, a 2025 homer guy with, you know, an OPS around, or I'm sorry, an on-base percentage around 330, 340, that's not necessarily the guy you want to lock up to that long-term deal if he's not doing the catching. So, you know, that's definitely, you know, we're barely into May now, and the Cardinals are telling people that Wilson Contreras is no longer going to do the catching.
They've lost 8 in a row. I think they're 10 out. To your point, you know, Wilson's batting .277, 2 home runs, 14 RBI in 32 games. To me, it seems a little bit of a cop-out or a little bit of a, you know, finger-pointing. Oliver Marmol.
Yeah,
you know, brought Mosliak in, John Mosliak in, and the pitching coach and Contreras, and had the powwow, and then they made the announcement and basically the demotion, right? I mean, he didn't go down there to be DH and outfielder, but I mean, when a team is underachieving to this degree, it's the catcher's fault.
Well, I mean, it's a, I mean, it is a drastic move, right? Like,
yeah.
To come out and say this so early. Again, they won't completely regret the deal, but again, you do not spend that type of money on Wilson Contreras to be a, you know, a left fielder for you or a designated hitter. That's a lot of money to tie up in a guy like that. It was always okay as a catcher, as an elite hitter. That's what you're buying into,
and all the intangibles too, right? I mean,
sure,
everyone loves the way he approaches the game and all that.
There were always the whispers that the Cubs were not big fans of the way
he
called the game. He framed, yeah. And the truth is that, you know, I think there's always been some stories circulating that they weren't always happy with the way Wilson Contreras interacted with umpires behind the plate, and sometimes the Cubs starting pitchers weren't fans of the fact that they thought they might be getting squeezed because
yeah.
Wilson Contreras felt the need to let umps know he disagreed with a lot of their calls, right? And so I think that all that stuff played into why the Cubs felt it was time to move on, and it is really jarring to see the Cardinals move him off of catching so quickly into his contract, less than 40 games into his, a 4 or 5 year deal, right?
And
a 5 year deal. Less than 40 games into the first season with him, they're like, all right, you're going to be an outfielder / DH. That is certainly not what they anticipated when
they signed him. Yeah, it's a little worse than designating Jake Diekman for assignment. you've got a little bit more. But, you know, I don't know. I think the Cardinals have gone something like 30 years where they've only had one sub-500 season. I mean, it's a ridiculous statistic,
mm-hmm.
right? They're always a winning team. And everyone points to that franchise as – for consistency, that's how you go about, you know, not necessarily winning World Series, and they actually had a 500 team win a World Series. But to be buried in this division this early and this deep, would you bet, if you had a dollar to bet, your last dollar, would mm-hmm. you bet on the Cardinals getting together and making a run or the White Sox getting together? Because the divisions are kind of, you know, similar in, you know, the Sox division is bad,
mm-hmm.
and the good teams in the Cubs division aren't good to this point. So
it's
upside down.
It's an interesting question. Let me ponder that. I'll give you my answer on the other side. We'll take your calls. 312-332-3776. Talking a little bit of baseball, Cubs with a nice win over the Marlins yesterday. They get the reigning Cy Young Award winner on the mound against them today in Sandy Alcantara, and he has not been good, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Brian's question, Cardinals versus White Sox. Who would you bet on turning things around quicker? And we do have to discuss what happened in Cincinnati yesterday. The White Sox were given some unexpected bad news before the game started, and they gave us an update as it unfolded later in the game. What's the latest on Eloy Jimenez? We'll tell you next on ESPN 1000.
Listen to us now, live on the ESPN Chicago app.
This is Chicago's home for sports, ESPN Chicago.
White Sox continue to get crushed injury blows. I don't know if this one's classified as an injury, but it's certainly going to hurt their lineup. Yesterday, we found out before the game from Pedro Grifol that Eloy Jimenez was dealing with some abdominal issues and pain. Woke
kind of
up
like the Sox fans.
yes. You are correct, Brian Hanley. Eloy Jimenez Friday night was not feeling great. And then he woke up Saturday morning and pain continued to intensify. So he was, of course, in touch with White Sox doctors, which is, you know, a good change of pace to let the doctors know when you're not feeling good. Eloy Jimenez did that. And, of course, he eventually was rushed to the hospital and at this point, not really a surprise, had an appendectomy. And so that was yesterday afternoon. And Pedro Grifol talked about him feeling better, obviously, after the surgery, and it looks like he's going to be out 4 to 6 weeks. So that is a pretty big blow for the White Sox, who did lose yesterday 5-3 to the Reds. This is Pedro Grifol after the game talking about how the White Sox are going to approach the lineup now that they're going to be without Eloy for a while.
He is our three-four-hole hitter, but he's swinging the bat really well. And Robert now swinging the bat really well. You know, today was his fourth extra game with extra base hits. It ties a career high for him. So being able to have those two guys swing the bat at the same time, hit a couple of other guys, and, you know, Marcano doing his rehab and all that stuff, you know, it's promising, but, you know, life, you know, deals you stuff you got to deal with, you know, and we got to move on. Thank God everything came out all right. Should be discharged tonight, and just get him back with us. You know, go back to start his rehab and take care of that. Like I said, those things are scary, and health is more important than anything.
White Sox manager Pedro Grifol yesterday after the game talking about Eloy Jimenez, of course, and he did take the opportunity to let people know that Luis Robert has bounced back since last Sunday when we were last on, Bri, which is, of course, encouraging.
Yeah, I mean, and this is such a microcosm of the Sox season and maybe Eloy's career, too.
Yeah.
He's 14 of 33, two homers, eight RBIs, six runs scored, 1.109 OPS with an eight-game hitting streak, and now he's sidelined for a month, month and a half. You ever had an appendectomy? I have not.
I have not, and it's actually one of the things, one of, like, when I start, like, listing things that, like, I have not even irrational, but something that's a big fear in my life. It's, you know, dealing with not knowing that, you know, what I'm dealing with and actually having to have an appendectomy, you know, that is concerning. One of those things where, like, that could be very, you know, it could result in death. So it's one of those things where a good thing that he, you know, got to the hospital and they get taken care of. And
the only surgery I've ever had was like arthroscopic knee surgery, mm-hmm. which was in and out in one day, right? Outpatient surgery.
Yep.
So I've never had a hernia any. And when you're an athlete, it's just, you know, to have to go through that and not know for a few hours what it is, but then end up going underneath going under the knife and being out. And the good news is they got it before it became a real situation, but it's so Sox, right? I mean, the guy's finally hitting a stride and doing what we know he's capable of doing. And now he's out for 6 weeks. And I mean, I don't know. We had them win their first series, come out Monday, Tuesday, come back with a 7-run inning. Everyone's like, hey, maybe they're turning the corner and they can still win the series. Here's hoping they do it today.
Mm-hmm.
But appreciably, a week's gone by and they haven't changed their lot, because you can't change your lot in 1 week given the start they've had.
Yeah, no, for sure. I will say there was some good news, as we did receive news about Liam Hendricks pitching a scoreless ninth inning the other day. So, you know, in Charlotte. So the hope is that they will have their closer back sooner rather than later. So there's, if you want to look at, you know, some bit of good news that would not be so Sox, you know, I will say that is the good news we got this week. And, you know, on the grand scale of things, much better, right? Like that Liam Hendricks is able to get back
terrific.
Out there.
I mean, how do you not, you know, root for that story and that man? And he had, I saw our buddy Fred Huebner, who mm-hmm. overcame cancer and beat cancer, the struck out cancer t-shirt Liam was wearing. Freddie tweeted out, I got to get me one of those shirts. And yes, you do, Fred.
Yes.
We ought to get you one. But I mean, it's great. It's great to hear the support he's had throughout baseball and the positive outlook. When he said, I didn't think why me, I thought, why not me? I mean, good Lord. Tells you about all you need to know about Liam Hendricks.
As good of a reliever and closer as he is, whenever he speaks publicly, I'm always like baffled, like, damn, that guy is so good at
right?
not just, he's so thoughtful on so many different topics and important topics, right? I love listening to Liam Hendricks talk and speak. And so, yeah, he's one guy who, as a White Sox fan, he is my personal favorite on the team right now. Yeah, I'm rooting for that guy really hard. And so hopefully he'll be back closing games out for the Sox fairly soon. And that would be a big uplifting story for that clubhouse to have him back soon. Let's try John, who's in Streamwood, 312-332-3776. That's how John got in, if you want to talk a little bit of baseball with us. John, what's going on? You're on with Meller and Hanley.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, John.
I have a baseball question. I'm one of the very rare fans of Chicago that follows both Chicago clubs. And I've got a question that affects both Chicago clubs. First of all, with the bases being larger, the base stealing bigger, so many teams are taking advantage of that, yet the Cubs and the Sox are not taking advantage of it. I do realize you've got a one or two players. Horner is a good example. You have one or two players that are stealing bases. That's it. You have one or two players. Are you telling me everybody in Squad Bell carrying a piano on their back? Wow. Those guys can't steal bases?
All right, John. So, yeah, you know what? I think Yasmani Grandal, well, not literally, he may metaphorically at times be carrying a piano on his back the way he does run. So I don't want, like, now, but I think your question is interesting, right? Should the Cubs and White Sox both be stealing more bases? It's not just the bigger bases, Bri, but also the, with the pitch clock now, runners, and honestly, the pitch clock is a bigger deal as to why you're seeing more bases being stolen all across baseball. It's because runners have the opportunity to know that, okay, a pitcher can only go over twice, and after that second throw over, if he goes a third time, he has to get me. And so there is just, base runners have a much better opportunity to really dissect pitchers and get that, you know, get that lead. And then they know, too, if they time it right, if a pitcher is waiting till deep into the pitch clock to actually go to the plate, well, you know, if you know you're close to 1 second, you can get ready and get that running lead. So it's not so much the bigger bases. It is the pitch clock, I think, that's affecting stolen bases across baseball, Bri. Should the Cubs be stealing a little bit more? I don't know who on the White Sox, really. I'm trying to think who's not taking advantage of the opportunity, because Tim Anderson, right, has been, you know, he's been out for a while, but he was certainly running more when the season began. If Billy Hamilton gets on base, he'll run. I promise you that.
Oh boy, and a lot of people don't even want to see him anywhere near the park, let alone the base paths. I believe the Sox started 12 for 12 with stolen bases.
Yeah, they did. You're right. You know, they did. They were perfect for a while. Yeah. I know. I remember Rick Hahn pointing that out.
Yeah, I don't know.
They're middle of the pack. They've got 34 steals.
Part of it's getting on base, and when you're chasing pitches, right, and you're not taking your walks, and Pedro's been banging that drum, you got to get more consistently, you know, get the lineup going, getting guys on to even have the opportunity. I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I'm with you. The pitch clock and the rules now dictating, I suppose, the extra couple inches around the circumference of the base helps.
I think it's a combination, certainly. Yeah.
But, John's right. I mean, if especially like the Cubs, it's great. Nico Horner is sitting there with his 12 stolen bases. But when the offense was going, it was the top two guys doing it, right? They finally had a double, you know, a daily double combination. Not exactly a he-go-we-go as you did with back in the day. But, you know, you have to have your opportunities to do so. And I think the Cubs offense, when it hasn't been clicking in the last 2 weeks, again, you're not getting guys on. You get the opportunity to get small ball. And yesterday was a really good example of that offense catching breaks in the eighth inning when the Marlins couldn't play defense.
Oof, I mean.
But the Amaya seeing eye grounder and even the Trey Mancini double, just he pokes it down the line opposite field. So, you know, they're not exactly tearing the cover off the ball, but that was an example yesterday of getting some breaks and putting the ball in play.
And you know what? Let me correct myself. I said 34. I was actually – I pulled up the MLB stats page for teams here because, unfortunately, I do not have stolen bases by teams across baseball memorized. Right. So the White Sox have played 34 games. They have 21 stolen bases. That is 17th in baseball. They're right in the middle there. The Cubs, meanwhile, though, they actually have 31 stolen bases in 33 games. They're actually sixth in baseball.
And I think that was mostly the first few, few weeks, first month of the season when the top of the order was getting on.
But it's certainly, it's not, Bellinger stole a base yesterday at a critical moment, right? It's certainly there. I don't think the Cubs, you can be too critical of them not running enough. I think they're, the players on their team who are capable of stealing bases, I think have, for the most part, at least from what I can tell, been given the opportunity to say, go ahead, take advantage of this. I think it's something that we're going to have to monitor throughout the season as it kind of unfolds, right? And as guys get a better idea of exactly how they want to attack pitchers on the mounds with this pitch clock and their moves over, I think we may see some teams really exploit this more than others. I know the Orioles, I remember, they were running everybody early in the season. So I think there's certainly an opportunity for teams to change the way they play as the season progresses and once they start to get more comfortable as a whole with the pitch clock. So I'm not going to make any snap judgments. I think it's a fair question. Should the Cubs run more? Maybe. We'll see. I'm not overly critical just yet, though. I want to give it a little bit of time.
If you look who's atop the stolen base standings, Ruiz with 16.
Yeah, for the A's. Yes, the A's.
So it doesn't always translate into, you know, swipe a base, win games, and off you go. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. I mean, if the opportunity's there, why not? And it's up. It was up early in the season. It's up 2 months into the season, a month into the season. So you might as well take advantage of the pitch clock and the new rules.
All right, and since we brought the pitch clock, this is a perfect opportunity to transition to maybe one of the few people who's actually critical of the pitch clock, but you might be surprised as to the reason why. I'll share with you what Jerry Reinsdorf thinks about it next.
This is Chicago's home for sports, ESPN Chicago.
Listen now in HD on our app and on ESPN 1000.
So this was amusing to me because I saw my partner Brian Hanley tweet earlier this week when Jesse Rogers pointed out how Major League Baseball's new rules impact 1 month in, particularly the game time because of the pitch clock. The game time has been reduced to an average of 2 hours and 36 minutes. That is the fastest since 1984. Brian simply retweeted that and said, "Game is better." And I don't know if that was because of all the other stuff as well, but I have to imagine the game time was one of the reasons that you truly believe the Major League Baseball has found a little bit, maybe stumbled into something, but they have figured out how to make the game more watchable. And I mean, am I reading too much into that, Bri, or are you just truly in love with the shift and the lack of it?
Look, all the rules, I came in being the old school guy. Why are you changing the game? Why are you changing it so significantly? But when I loved baseball growing up. Mm-hmm. I loved playing it. We played Sandlot every day in the summer till the sun went down. Then we'd go play wiffle ball with the lights on the garage in the backyard after that till we had to go in. And the younger, you know, kids don't do that. I mean, you can drive by parks, empty parks, anywhere in the city or in the suburbs, and kids just don't play baseball, and they're not watching. You talked about just going on Twitter and watching, you know, the Derby in 2 minutes and not watching the 8 hours of a pomp and circumstance and broadcast. You know, the idea is that kids aren't playing baseball and they're not interested in baseball. And part of the reason people believe is it takes too long. There's too much downtime. There's not enough action. It's not in the TikTok generation. Everything's got to be under a minute. And even in my advanced age, it's a better game.
Yes.
There's just I don't need to see a guy step off the rubber 10 times. I don't need to see a guy fix his batting gloves 8 times. It's a better game. It's a faster. When I covered baseball, and you know, I was like, everyone's like, well, what sport did you know you like to cover the least? And I love baseball. It was my favorite sport growing up. Mm-hmm. But believe me, when you're covering a game and there's two out in the bottom of the ninth, and all of a sudden the team's down 2-0, down to a last strike, and they tie the game up. And next thing you know, the thunderstorm hits, and you're there till 3 a.m. because there's a power outage.
Yeah, no fun, like, no bueno.
Yeah, it's a better game, and the shift too. You saw some the hits yesterday for the Cubs. If they'd been shifting, those would have just been routine outs, right?
Yeah, no, they're unquestionably, I think everything they've done in conjunction is working together. Theo Epstein, the consultant who has helped really usher in bringing back the beauty to baseball, I think they've done a nice job. And all these rule changes have made it a more aesthetically pleasing game for the viewer, which is great. What was interesting to me, amongst many of the things that White Sox and Bulls owner Jerry Reinsdorf said this past week at the Milken Institute's 2023 Global Conference panel, he mentioned the pitch clock in passing when he was talking about the importance that gambling has played to the popularity of professional sports. Take a listen.
Gambling really was a major reason why the NFL became as successful as it did. Great sport. People love the game. But the gambling was very important. The other sports, at the same time, did everything they could to discourage betting, worried that betting could lead to fixing of games. I think people ultimately realized it's not possible anymore because with today's technology, if odds move, they have to move if money moves, that you're going to spot it right away. And players are not going to throw games for $10,000.
Right.
But the betting, gambling allows people to actually think they're participating in the outcome of the game. And now that you can do it on your phone, you can sit in a stadium and do it on your phone, I think it's going to grow dramatically. I don't know how fast, but it will grow dramatically. I mean, think about a baseball game. You can bet on, is the next pitch going to be a ball or a strike? Will the runner try to steal a base? Will it be a home run? And there are a million different propositions you can be able to bet on. And baseball may have made a mistake by speeding up the games this year. Because while people want faster games, they want to get early, there's less time to bet between the pitches. so maybe we made a mistake.
You got to love it. You got to love it, Bri. Everybody is applauding Major League Baseball for even you. You know, you come out and say, listen, I was somebody who was kicking and screaming reluctance about the idea of changing all these rules. And sure enough, I love Jerry Reinsdorf pointing out, hey, this pitch clock thing, it's making the game go by faster. But you know what? We may have cost ourselves some dollars.
Okay. I mean, there's so much there. First of all, the NFL kept that at arm's length. It was illegal gambling that kept, you know, the NFL popularity going. They just finally gave up because the gravy train was rolling by without them and the hundreds of millions of dollars they could put in their pocket. And now with baseball, we have a sports book being built at Wrigley Field. You have one in the United Center. I guess you could have one. The state owns the rate, so I don't know how that's. How many people actually gamble in the percentage wise of sports fans? I mean, those who do it probably to an extent that's not healthy. But I think the average sports fan still goes to the ballpark or the stadium, the United Center, to enjoy the game and to follow their team and to you know, because their favorite player, the team's doing well. I don't know that it's, I would think less than 10%.
Yeah.
Actually are sitting there with the app open. I mean, back in the day, the bleacher bums would sit there with all the downtime between pitches and bet whether the next pitch was a ball or a strike, right?
Yeah,
and
sure.
Pass the dollar, like for a dollar a wager.
Cup game or anyone who's ever played the cup game, you know, in the bleachers where you throw in a dollar, you hold the, everybody anties up, you all throw in a dollar, and then you hold the, you pass the cup, everyone gets a turn, and then the batter, if he makes an out, you throw a buck in. If he gets a base hit or reaches base, you take a dollar out. If he hits a home run, you get the whole cup, and then everybody re-anties. Yeah, like I remember going to baseball games, you know, when I was 12, 13 years old and being introduced to that game and loving it, right? It did make every at-bat that much more fun and interesting to watch. But you
made the time go by, too.
Of course. You know,
because now there's no time to go by.
I mean, yes.
The hitter has to be engaged with the pitcher with 8 seconds to go. And you couldn't pass the cup around to get the money in. But if Jerry thinks that's his biggest concern right now, God bless him. Because he said some other things there, too. This is why Jerry hasn't been out there publicly in front of the microphones near as much in the last few years as we used to see him and hear from him.
I was stunned to see some of the stuff that came out from that conference on Monday.
Yeah,
and it did lead me to wonder, did Jerry Reinsdorf, was he aware that this was all being recorded and would be made available for public consumption? Because the way he went into some stuff, it was like, do you really want to do you want to broadcast that to everybody out there and let them know that this is truly, like, maybe he just doesn't give a damn anymore. You know, he's been so successful as an owner for so long that it's no big deal, no skin off his back, right? But I certainly was confused by some of the things that he was more than happy to say out loud.
Okay, after the break, yes. We have to define success, because you are correct. He's a very successful owner on the business ledger.
Yes.
And what he said in that conference echoed almost to the very word what he supposedly told the Marlins president David Sampson a few years ago, and the White Sox said, oh, no, he doesn't remember saying that. He never said that. And yeah. it brings it right back to the question of how much does Jerry want to win? Not just how much money he wants to put in the bank. And if you own any kind of sports organization, whether yours is successful or not, you see the prices these organizations are going for when they're put up for sale, even the crap ones, right?
Yep.
Every year they go up 15, 20% in value if you don't do a damn thing. And so what's Jerry's business plan? What is his end game? And we can talk about that after the break.
He's Brian Hanley. I'm Jeff Meller. We'll do that next.
Follow Chicago's Home for Sports on Twitter at ESPN 1000. This is Chicago's Home for Sports, ESPN Chicago.
You on Sunday morning till 11 o'clock here on ESPN 1000 and the ESPN Chicago app. I mentioned Jerry Reinsdorf being hugely successful as an owner, and you pressed me on that, Brian, as we were heading to break.
Well, 1998 was the last of six championships for the Bulls. God bless them. I mean, historic. Last dance, we all still celebrate that. 2005, a long time ago, too, right, to win a World Series.
But it seems like yesterday.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Haven't won a playoff series in forever, a decade or more. So, Jerry, at this business seminar ESPN put on, whatever it was, the Milken Institute, went on to say, I think the important thing for fans is while they want you to win championships, they want to know that when they get down to the last month of the season, you still have a shot. You're still playing meaningful games. If you can do that consistently, you will make your fans happy. So just be in it at the end. Don't have to win anything necessarily or on a regular basis, and you'll have a very happy fan base. I don't believe that to be the case, but okay. That certainly hasn't been the Sox experience for a long time. Back in 2019, the young president of the Marlins then, David Sampson, said that when he was 32 years old, Jerry Reinsdorf said, you know what? Told them this, you know what? Here's my best advice to you. Finish in second place every single year because your fans will say, wow, you've got a great shot. We're in it. But there's always the carrot left. There's always one more step to take. The White Sox, when Sampson said that publicly, the White Sox said, oh, Jerry doesn't remember saying that. He'd never say that. We're all here to win, blah, blah, blah. But basically what he said this week sure echoes what Sampson said, what, 4 years ago.
Here is Reinsdorf at the Milken Institute.
The first week I was in sports, somebody said to me, if you listen to the fans, you'll soon be sitting with the fans. And so you can't allow your decisions to be guided by emotion or what you think people want. At the same time, you have to consider what the fans are thinking or they're not going to buy your tickets. So it's unbelievably different than the real world. It really is. And I've just resolved all the inconsistencies by trying to win as often as I can, knowing you can't. It's a game of failure. Think about baseball. If somebody gets three hits every 10 times up, he's failed 70% of the time. Sports is a business of failure. Only one team is going to win every year. But the fact that you finish second or third or fourth, it doesn't mean you had a bad year. I think the important thing to fans is while they want you to win championships, they want to know that when you get down to the last month of the season, you still have a shot. You're still playing meaningful games. If you can do that consistently, you'll make your fans happy.
Now, when you hear him, I agree. You know, we'll take them. I guess you will take the White Sox denial and say, okay, maybe he didn't say that to David Sampson. But when you listen to what he said right there, I agree with an aspect of that. You know, it is, as a fan, you're always looking for a championship. And when you come up short, you know, it's hard, especially because oftentimes there's a finality to the season when it ends abruptly and you have high expectations and you want your team, you want to be celebrating a championship. It sucks when you end that way, and it's hard sometimes to look at the totality of a season and say, you know what, the journey was fun. I had a lot of fun with this winning baseball team. So the problem is he talks about that, your fan base wanting you to be competitive, you know, into that last month of the season. But I think the truth is that the White Sox and even the Bulls oftentimes, far too often, are not competitive enough in the last month of the season to really feel as a fan like your team truly does care about winning.
Well, and here's the thing. With the Bulls, even though they haven't won a championship since 1998, there were years where they were competitive. They were in it to the end of the season. They built such a loyal base and had such a phenomenal run with Michael Jordan and Phil and the entire crew. They had a sellout streak of more than 20 years, which was inexplicable because the product didn't say that everyone should be going through the turnstiles to the point where there are no empty seats in the place all those years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you heard Jerry say, well, you want to win because the fans won't buy your tickets. Well, the fans haven't been buying their tickets a long time. Right now, they're 22nd in attendance and averaging about 18,000, 17,933 in 15 home games. So beginning of last year when they were scuffling big time, a friend of mine's an investor and has been in on the ground floor with Jerry's business group. And Jerry is the managing partner of this of the investors. When they bought the team back in 1980, 1981, I think he owned like 12 or 13%. He's not the majority owner. Mm-hmm. He may be now. He's bought up a lot of the minority owners and bought them out as the years have gone by, because many years have gone by. But again, he's the managing partner. He has been very successful for the investors in this. And so I talked to a friend of mine who's an investor. We were texting back and forth. And I'm like, hey, doesn't he care? Most CEOs, companies, they have a fiduciary duty to maximize revenue and do all you can to get every dollar out of your product, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at all those empty seats. And boy, we saw it earlier in the week. Again, the team hasn't given the Sox fans any reason to come out to the gates or the rate, so I'm not blaming them. But the seven-run comeback, it looked like back in the days when Frank Thomas didn't want anyone in watching batting practice.
Yeah.
The place was empty, right?
Yep.
I asked this guy, a friend of mine, I'm like, hey, as an investor, aren't you ticked off when you look around and see all the empty seats, not buying the great food, which is tops in baseball, and enjoying, you know, the tailgating and everything goes along with your Sox experience? I mean, as an investor, don't you want to see more fannies in the seat, buy a beer and buying tickets? And look, and he takes umbrage, my friend takes umbrage with me, that the state owns, you know, gave them a sweetheart deal when they threatened to move to Tampa.
Yep.
Then Governor Jim Thompson twisted arms and gave them everything they want, to the point where if they didn't sell, I believe it was $2 million tickets in a season, the state started cutting checks to subsidize tickets that weren't sold. I mean, they still don't own the stadium. Why would you? Because you've got the best sweetheart deal. If you could rent an apartment like with that kind of a deal, you would never move. And he said, you're looking at it all wrong. He said, as investors, and I think the White Sox bought that team like the Cubs for about $20 million, $21 million when it was sold back in the day. It's worth, Forbes said, I think, a little over $2 billion. And believe me, if they sold it, put it on the market today, they'd probably get $3 or more billion dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
He said, you're looking around. It's like you're buying a treasury bond, a long-term investment. You're not looking for month-to-month
returns.
No. You got in, you trust, and Jerry, you trust, and why wouldn't you? Because he's a wildly successful businessman. See the lease they signed and see the amount of money that franchise is worth versus the $20 million they paid for it. And when they sell the team, everyone's going to get the return on their money, and that is going to be more, that's going to be generational money for all those families involved. And so my whole question to him was, where is the incentive to win if you have all you're worried about is keeping your costs low. And Jesse points it out all the time we talk baseball. Sox won three teams without a $100 million contract. They have a list of things they do not do. And in a major market, they operate in a very smart business sense. They don't overextend themselves. And their payroll actually went down after last year, right?
Yep.
Now, money doesn't necessarily equate to winning, but where's your incentive to win? If it's just about we own this piece of property that goes up in value each and every year, no matter who's out there playing on the property, where's your incentive to win? Where's your incentive to do anything other than what you've been doing?
It's a fair question. Hold that thought. We're going to compare and contrast Jerry Reinsdorf with a new school owner, a brand new school owner, Matt Ishbia, who just bought the Suns a few months ago. I'll share with you how he approaches owning a franchise, and we'll compare that to Jerry Reinsdorf's comments. We'll do that in 2 short minutes.